And of course, we're going to take your phone calls this hour with Sir Charles Schulz about space, technology, and everything else you can think of when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Sir Charles Schulz III with us. We'll get to your call. Sir Charles, of all the fossils that you've looked at on Mars, which is the one that fascinates you the most?
I think it's the crinoid from Sol 111 found by Opportunity. It has five teardrop look.
Up? Did we lose you? Charles, are you there? Yep, we'll try to call you back. He simply vanished and disappeared. Oh, well, but I have phone calls. We'll go to them. And Charles, you know, I know you want to talk to Sir Charles Schulz, but it's me. We got to get him back on. But go ahead. What was your question?
Are you talking from me, Los Angeles?
Yes, I sure am.
Oh, well, I wondered, was he talking about Sirius B, the planet? It sounded like Sirius, but...
Yeah, S-E-R-E-S, I believe it's spelled.
I thought it was S-I-R-I-U-S.
S-I-R-I-U-S.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's I think it's S-E-R-E-S. I'm pretty sure.
Not the one I'm thinking of. The Sirius B is the planet that Jesus of Nazareth is
no,
from.
No. That's not the one.
And a friend of mine lived there also in another lifetime. They told him about 3 years ago they can get here in about 7 minutes our time.
How do they do that?
They didn't explain it. They just there was somebody else you had on the show from another planet or spoke about another planet, too, and they said they could get here in about 7 minutes our time. I've forgotten which planet that was, but...
That's pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't go the speed of light. They just... They're here, Sirius B, and many others are here to help us make the spiritual changes pretty soon.
Okay, you got it. But no, I'm pretty sure it's S-E-R-E-S. That's the one that we're talking about. Little tiny planetoid. Simple as that. TJ's in Minnesota, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program, TJ. We're still waiting to find Sir Charles Schulz. They've taken him somewhere.
Yeah, stand by. Yeah.
You got it.
I think Sir Charles is more correct with Sirius. I think it's a dog star. But, you know, we've had depopulation for a generation now, and the UN tells us otherwise. So while Europe and North America have negative population growth and China has zero population growth, we're supposed to believe the UN when they say, oh, suddenly we got 9 billion people. We just had 4 million in 2001. This is so crazy. If you believe that...
Yeah, okay, I get the picture. I get the picture. Hey, we found Sir Charles. Did you have a power outage there?
Yes, all of a sudden everything went down here, and it's come back up now, but at least we have the cell phone backup line.
Are you in tough storms, or what's going on weather-wise?
No, it's very odd. We're in Orlando. Everything's calm, but every now and then it seems like some things go off here. Don't understand why.
Backed up by the cell phone, so we'll use this while you're on for the next 45 minutes.
Sure, that won't be a problem.
Super. Let's go to some more calls for you, Charles. Let's go to Kevin in Connecticut on the wild card line. Kevin, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George. Good morning, George. I'm very much enjoying the interview. And
thank you.
Sir Charles, that just goes to show you got to be careful who you talk to. glad we were able to get you back. My question is, given the things you've talked about, and of course we know they're all interconnected, where do you think we are? How far away do you think we are from finding, identifying, utilizing an actual plausible, renewable, manageable, realistic energy source to power our planet? I mean, we're messing around with wind. The way we do nuclear power is very clumsy. We haven't figured out how to harness energy from the sun effectively yet. We're working on all these things. What do you think's happening in that regard, Sir Charles?
Actually, we have a number of power sources that would work quite reliably. I think one of the big things right now in renewable energy is the lack of a good storage system. There's plenty of wind, there's plenty of sun, and even though they're not constant, if we had the proper means of storing them and playing it back later, we'd be in great shape just with the existing solar cells and windmills we have. and that would cover a great deal of our power needs right away very reliably. We also have a huge amount of power available in ocean currents and waves, and that's not being exploited at all. But if you really want to get right down to it, I know people are tired of having to burn stuff to make power, and I think that fusion power is probably our best bet. There are a number of researchers who are working on it right now, getting very positive results. And in my estimation, within the next 5 years or less, we should see some very reliable hydrogen-powered fusion systems hitting the market.
No doubt. And the dwarf planet you were talking about, Ceres, it's the one with, it's C-E-R-E-S, isn't it?
That's correct. That's Ceres, yes.
Okay, understand. You know, we continue to find more and more planets all over the place. You know, what was the estimate a long time ago? Billions of planets?
Yeah, they had some basic estimates, and they said, well, if only 1 out of 10 stars in our Milky Way had planets like ours, and they had roughly 9, 10 planets, boy, we'd still have hundreds of billions of planets in our galaxy. Well, just this last year, we found 715 new extrasolar planets that weren't detected before, and some of them are just a bare 6.5 light years away from us. So we're having some amazing luck detecting planets all over our galaxy. And the estimates are right now there could be as many as 1 trillion worlds that could be suitable for life similar to what we see on the Earth.
It's amazing. I just love what's going on in science and space. Listen to this story. A local, they call it a local orange dwarf star, has a 90% possibility of passing within the orbit of our outer solar system. And there could be some kind of collision way out there. But nonetheless, it's still our solar system.
Well, you know, as stars move around, there are really no boundaries from one solar system to the next. Stars can approach very closely to each other, and their planetary systems overlap. Their Oort clouds, all the icy bodies in their outer areas, can easily intermingle. And we sometimes get meteorites here on Earth that clearly have the signatures that are coming from other solar systems. So that's not surprising.
What do you think of asteroids, and when do we get slapped with one?
Well, we know of a couple of thousand that cross the Earth's orbit right now, and it could happen at any time. Fortunately, we've got some pretty good technology for detecting them, and it's getting better all the time. All the time sounds like pretty optimistic. But when you stop and think about how many tens of thousands of years have been humans on the planet, and we haven't been clobbered by a big one yet, that's pretty reassuring. But it also makes us feel that maybe we're overdue. We come close enough to enough material every year to see a number of fireballs in the sky, and they're reported all the time. And I know that people are aware of the ones that crossed our path and hit Russia a couple of years ago.
That's right.
So right now, to be honest, we have no way of deflecting anything that might come to the Earth, but we do have some means of detecting it. So it's just a matter of time before we then put our technologies together and have the ability to move an asteroid before it hits us.
Charles is in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to the show. Charles, go ahead, sir.
Yes, and thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Why is technology getting so difficult for people who are blind? For example, Everybody assumes everybody can look at the screen. Well, that's not true. Not everybody can. And it makes it very difficult to buy things. Like, I know Comcast, I'm sorry to mention names, but they have they're finally coming up with a system that, you know, a talking TV guide. But why are things so difficult that, you know, the way things are going, we're not going to be able to use anything?
Well, you had a very good point. I think a lot of people are not fully aware of the fact that there's a significant portion of our population that can't see or can't see well enough to do anything with an image or image data. This is something that seems to have been ignored. As technical revolutions occur, we expect that things are going to get better for everybody, and the blind are being left out. There are a number of screen options, such as the pin screen, and I'm sure that you're aware of that, but they just can't keep up with the resolution, and they can't carry the density of information that a good, solid image does. But on the positive side, we're seeing some real advances in technologies that can repair neural damage, can repair optical damage. I'm hoping that very, very soon, through the use of stem cells and printers, as we discussed earlier, we may have the ability to create eyes for people who have not yet seen. I think this is going to happen. I'm very optimistic about that because we've seen real advances in hearing, and it's time for a revolution in seeing.
It sure is. William is in Fairfield, California now, west of the Rockies. William, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you doing, George?
We're good, thanks. Just getting ready for the new year.
Well, it's going to be quite an outstanding new year. Well, I know this is going to sound pretty strange, but I want to thank Sir Charles for succeeding in sending a message to the past years from now.
Well, okay. Good.
And I feel very humbled and being the recipient of part of that message. I had a surgery back in 2011, and it was a cutting edge thing with the brain, where I was in and out of the surgical situation for about 10 days, and that's where I received the message from Sir Charles, and there was other folks there that coaxed me into deciphering some things. On the topic of blindness, one of the gifts that came to me through the process that will aid in correcting macular degeneration is a visor. If it hasn't been made yet, but if somebody could make this visor with cobalt blue LED lights placed at one at 2:15 and one at 9:45 in the corners of the goggles, with different apertures, and the person just focuses forwards, and what this does it transfers the neural connections in the mind to the reboot. I'm not a doctor. I don't know how that stuff works, but it works. It will work.
And when it does, what does it do to them, though?
Well, it's a backup system in the brain. That's the best I could explain it. I'm not a.
Do you follow him, Charles? I don't.
Well, actually, it's interesting. Some people have used shortwave and longwave light to stimulate neural activity. And right now, if you look at an MRI, you can only see large groups of cells. You can't actually tell what a neuron is doing. But using laser light or using lead light to stimulate and measure neural activity is actually a known process. It just isn't terribly refined at this point. I think that's what he's saying.
Do you remember years ago kids were watching a video game and, you know, they would all be almost like hypnotized because of it?
Yes, absolutely. And there is a frequency right around 14.75 hertz that if you watch something flashing or oscillating at that rate, it seems to induce a state of stupor. And they used to make a thing called drunken lights that were available in bars sometimes in the past. They would have a series of little neon lights that would flicker at that rate, and it would make people feel uncomfortable. If you watch one, it makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. It seems to work at a frequency that triggers certain unpredictable actions in the brain, similar to epilepsy.
Next up, we go to Matt, truck driving in Illinois, east of the Rockies. Matt, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good evening, George and Mr. Charles.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a question about artificial graft. And it's actually kind of a two-part question, too. Do you think we will ever start building spaceships in space?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it makes a lot of sense to send basic materials up there and then assemble them in space. And here's the reason why. A lot of spacecraft in space don't have to undergo a lot of stress once they're in space. It's the launch stresses that make things liable to break. And if you're launching I'll give you an example. Would you carry a wedding cake, or would you carry the ingredients to make the cake? It's a lot easier to carry the ingredients through whatever conditions and then put the cake together when you arrive. Well, the same principle applies for a complex thing like a spacecraft. It's much easier to bring the components of a spacecraft up as the bare components and then assemble them once you get there. So if you really want to do it sensibly, you send up an assembly system, 3D printers, whatever you need, and the raw materials, and then you build the spacecraft in space.
So, Charles, when you got knighted, tell me how that all happened for you.
Well, I had done some work in research in nuclear fusion, and the results were extremely positive. And Dr. Nelson Ying, who is the Baron of Ball Klein, decided to give me what is known as the Ying Genius Award. And part of that was being knighted as a Knight of the Barony of Ball Klein, which is in Aberdeenshire, Scotland. And so there
cool.
was a ceremony and a sword. And
did you have to kneel down and they put the sword by your shoulders and stuff like that, just like we see in the movies?
It's very similar to that. He stands higher than I do and then taps you on each shoulder. There is basically an affirmation that you're going to perform your services for the good of humanity, and that was one of the big terms. I had to be knighted to the service of solving the problems of humanity, not just a specific locality or political entity. And so it was a very important decision to decide to devote your life to something that's very worthwhile and beneficial to everyone.
What a great honor.
It is indeed. It's one that I carry very closely inside.
Next up, let's go to Joe Bronx in New York. Joseph, take it away.
Hey, Charles, how you doing?
Yeah.
I had a question dealing with space. How soon do you think asteroids can be populated? And can we name the first populated asteroid Astrotropolis?
I'm glad that's all you said.
Yes. I think that it could be named pretty much whatever the population voted, or in the case if it's owned by a company, whatever they vote by the shareholders vote for. Yes, you can populate asteroids. The big issues there are being certain that you're shielded from radiation and conditions such as collision. It would make the most sense to bore into the interior of an asteroid where the constant temperature would serve you well, and the shielding of the bulk of the material would keep impacts from being a problem, and it would cut down on the amount of radiation you'd be exposed to. And in the process, the material you bored out to create the Warren, or the spacecraft inside the asteroid, would be the material you use to produce all your industrial goods. There's an unlimited amount of minerals, metals, and organic material in many different asteroids. And incidentally, there's 5 different types of asteroid. So you have a lot to choose from, and yes, I'm certain that we'll see that happen in the future.
Who wants to live on an asteroid, Sir Charles?
Well, imagine being able to have an entire huge open space that you literally could fly in, wearing nothing more than plastic wings. Imagine being able to farm a place that surrounds you 360 degrees on all sides, above and below, with your greenery and sunlight in all directions. I can think that it would be a very interesting and unusual place to live.
I wouldn't go, would you?
I'd certainly visit. I don't know if I'd live there long term, but I would certainly visit it.
A rocky asteroid.
Absolutely. I mean, after all, look at what people do to the inside of an old trailer sometimes, or an old rundown building. They throw their shag carpet and their mood lighting in, and they make it acceptable.
Off you go. All right, stay with us. We're coming back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, have you liked us on Facebook and followed us on Twitter? You can do that by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com. I'll be back in a moment with Final Calls with Sir Charles in just a moment. Beyond Belief, that's our television program. It's available for you to watch, a free series to watch. So simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com, where you get it all. Psychics, hard news, conspiracies, all done in a studio. Beyondbelief.com. And we're back with Final Phone Calls with our special guest, Sir Charles Schultz III, and of course your phone calls. Sir Charles, you've looked at also freezing light. What is that?
Basically, it's creating a condition where the light does not move or is captured for a period of time, ranging upwards of a minute at this time. It's an amazing ability to stop light in its tracks, and it shows us some extremely interesting properties. For instance, we've been able to create what's called solid light, you know, and it makes people think of the holodeck on Star Trek. Actually, it's nothing like that. Normally, light particles, photons, don't interact with each other. They simply pass right by each other. When you freeze light, you're able to have the photons interact with each other. And this is interesting because it means they can perform the same functions as quantum computing. So freezing light has the ability to stop light in its tracks, but it also means we can do quantum mechanical computing.
All right, so Charles, you're breaking up a little bit. So while I'm talking to you, I'm going to have Tom call your cell phone again, and we'll use that, okay?
Sure, that sounds fine.
All right, so you get ready to do that, and you're going to, don't hang up, just he's going to go and do his thing. He's going to call the cell phone, pick that up, and I'll flip you over once he gets you there. Simple as that. And then we'll go to the final calls once again. He has had some power outage problems, and you could hear that rapid little click-click sound, and just unusable for us here on this network program. So let's go back to Sir Charles and the magic of technology. You talk about technology, Charles. Look at this.
This is amazing.
Yep. Simple as that. We did a switch, right? Just
yes,
like
indeed.
That. It looked like magic. Let's go to Mary in Salt Lake City, Utah, west of the Rockies. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I'm sorry, I have a cold.
Well, I hope you feel better.
I am so interested in all of the things you've been discussing. But my question is, how are we going to get out from under the thumb of Wall Street in order to take advantage of them? I will do anything I can, but it doesn't matter to me which party is in. I don't think they're going to let us take advantage of them, and I don't know how we can. Do you have any ideas?
Well, unfortunately, that's not the topic of the night tonight, Mary, or politics with Sir Charles. But
if I understood politics, I wouldn't be a scientist.
Yeah, and you know what? I think you should prefer being a scientist. You'll have more fun doing that.
I do.
Better end results and everything else. What do you think could be the most dramatic breakthrough in science in the next 10 years?
Well, you know, we've talked about a lot of things, printing organs and life extension because you don't have to die from a missing liver. Or we've talked about power systems. We've talked about space travel. We've talked about quantum mechanics. I think that maybe the most amazing thing is the fact that we now have devices that show greater than unity. And this is this sounds like a slap in the face of everybody who studies physics. And this is going to expand. Our understanding is going to expand. We now have a device called a reactionless thruster. It doesn't throw any fuel out the back like a rocket engine, but it provides thrust. And people thought that this was impossible. Well, now we have this thing. We turn on some electrical power, and it moves. And it doesn't have any sort of exhaust of any sort. We also have an LED that shows greater than 100% efficiency. They have measured up to 231% efficiency, and that sounds insane. But the way it works is you put in a tiny amount of power, and the crystal inside the LED literally extracts thermal energy from the random movements of its own atoms and converts it to light energy.
Huh.
So it puts out more light than the amount of power that you put in. So we discovered that we actually can harvest a little bit of the random motion of atoms or molecules around us and put it to use. Now, this is an amazing breakthrough. Nobody would have suspected that you could do it. Mathematically, some physicists knew that there wasn't a law against it, but we've actually demonstrated it. So we've got a couple of devices that seem to do things that would have been impossible. Now, just imagine if we can continue working with quantum mechanical effects and discover ways to get enough energy to power machinery of sizable dimensions, such as generators or motors, lighting systems. We literally might find ways to draw enough power from the environment around us to provide energy to run everything we need. If we could do that, we literally would beat every limitation we have on energy right now. That one thing could probably be the most significant thing we do. And the ability to move things around without throwing fuel out of the back, if you could power those on this same sort of energy that we can draw from the vacuum or from the random thermal energy around us, we really would have some amazing technology. Imagine being able to drive a vehicle on literally no energy.
That would be amazing. I'd love it for our houses to be self-contained as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Next up, we go to Vancouver in Canada, International Line. Rod's with us. Hey, Rod, thank you. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm thrilled to hear the good news in all these technology fronts. But, my question to Sir Charles is, I cannot help but have a very bad feeling for planet Earth over the next century or two in terms of the social and ecological and political landscapes. And, you know, my fear is, without meaning to be, you know, I'm not a cynical person by nature, but I worry that we're headed to a kind of dark ages, that all these negative forces are going to dominate and knock technology development off course. Any thoughts on that?
You know what? I think the most powerful influences are our own intellects. We have to educate ourselves. It is our responsibility to protect our society and our families and everyone from that sort of a future. So the only way we can do that is to educate ourselves. Every day we have to learn something. We have to do something positive for those around us and for ourselves. I think that really our issue is we've allowed the wrong people to take the reins and lead us down the wrong path for too long. It's time to turn that around, and we're the only ones who can do it. Nobody's going to step in and do it for us. We personally have to take the responsibility to make this a better world.
Well, and it's got to be done, I think, on a worldwide basis as well, don't you think?
There's no question. That's the only way it will ever be achieved. It's like the blades of grass. Each little blade of grass doesn't produce a whole lot of food for the cows, or it doesn't produce a whole lot of oxygen, but it does produce a little. And pretty soon you've got 10 and 100 and 1,000 and a billion blades of grass, and every one of them is doing a little bit positive. We personally have to be the same way.
Let's go to Kansas City, Missouri, east of the Rockies. Sean's with us now. Sean, go ahead.
Dr. George, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Sir Charles, how are you also?
Quite well, thank you.
I took a trip. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri. This is Sean Breck. We drove down through the southwest and saw it looked like almost like a cotton field. It had so many of the windmills in the air.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, what can we do easier? I'm standing next to the Missouri River every day just looking at it, going, all this free perpetual motion just going by naturally. Why can't we make like an old paddle wheel like the steamboat days or something similar? Turn it sideways and put hundreds in each city up and down the rivers, just generating power all day long.
Well, actually, we can. And right now, there is a system called the micro hydro turbine, which can draw enough power from the movement of water to actually be beneficial. You can run a small household off a small micro turbine right now. I think one of the issues we will run into is water rights. Right now, unless you own the body of water or the river that's flowing across your land, it's probably going to be difficult for you to start harvesting that energy for your own use. And cities, well, now you start getting to the point where you need to build a dam to harvest enough power to do some good. Right now, we're in a very interesting situation because of the water rights situation in this country. But you're absolutely right. There is enough energy all around us using alternative methods to meet much of our need right now. I know right now we need to develop new battery systems. Graphene, in my opinion, is the way to go.
It's going to be huge.
Yes, indeed it will.
Yep. It will be better than fiber optics, won't it? And carbon fibers?
You know what? Graphene is probably the best new material we have. It has so many properties that are fantastic. It's incredibly strong. It's a wonderful electrical conductor. It's about two dimensions. It's flat as it can possibly be. It's only an atom thick. And they're discovering new applications for it every day. They recently found that graphene has the ability to take hydrogen right out of the atmosphere and store it. So we could probably make graphene filters that trap hydrogen for us for free right out of the air at
Amazing.
Some point.
How was that discovered?
You know, graphene was originally discovered by accident by fracturing a piece of graphite, and it was later found that if you put scotch tape, of all things, on it, you could peel a thin, atom-thick layer off of the surface and actually measure and quantify its properties. Later, they found that they could make it out of a material called graphitic oxide, which is literally graphite particles with an oxygen atom on them. And the first people to produce graphene in sheets took graphitic oxide in solution, put it on a CD, put it in a computer, and burned the disk. And in doing so, they produced a thin sheet of graphene that they could peel off. And it turned out to be a wonderful capacitor for storing and playing back energy. So that was the beginning of the revolution.
Let's go to Oceanside, California. Now it's Colleen's turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Colleen.
Greetings, George and Sir Charles. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have had this question in my mind since the Big Bang Theory came out, and we talk about looking out into space back in time. But if we're all expanding, and the Earth is in this expansion, isn't there somewhere where we could look out and see into the future or the recent past future?
Well, if you look at all the light from around us, and it's older than where we are at the newest point from our standpoint. And no matter where in the universe you go, you are at the newest point in time. So there is no individual point that is newer than right now. It would be very difficult mathematically or practically to describe a way that you could find a viewpoint where you'd be looking into the future.
When we are trying to investigate and create new technologies, like nuclear fusion,
right?
Why does it take so long?
Well, actually, that's pretty easy. A lot of times, it's not what we know, it's what we think we know that is wrong. We have to unlearn a lot of things many times. You know, I'll give you an example. Years ago, we were told that nuclear fusion and nuclear fission, each at opposite ends of the spectrum of elements, terminated at the bottom at iron, where you couldn't get energy out from fission or fusion. And it was always assumed that fusion had to occur only with very light elements, and fission could only occur with very heavy elements. And so people stuck to that belief for many years, and it made them not consider other options. Well, then they discovered that fission or fusion of a light element to a heavier element could occur, and you could get a yield of energy. And this threw everything out the window. Suddenly there was a revolution, and many people are investigating the low-energy nuclear reactions now as a result. So a lot of times we have to unlearn what we think we know before we can make real progress.
Now, that's so true. Jim's in Pensacola now. Welcome to the program, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Thanks a lot, George and Sir Charles.
Sure thing.
I wonder if you're familiar with the water ice discovery on Mercury and how it got there, and the hexagonal shape on the North Pole of Saturn and the tone that it's emitting.
Yes, actually, the water ice on Mercury is at its poles down in deep craters, and the reason it's there is because apparently comets have deposited water ice there, or perhaps some came from it within the ground. But it remains frozen there because those areas remain in the dark and never become warm enough for that ice to melt or sublimate away. And so we've also discovered similar deposits on the moon at the South Pole between three particularly deep craters. This is not unexpected. Any place in the solar system that gets cold enough for that sort of ice, water ice, to stay there and be undisturbed will continue to accumulate it over a period of time. Now, the hexagonal structure that you're referring to, if you look at the poles of Saturn, the rings in the clouds, the bands in the clouds, form a wonderful, perfect hexagon. And this appears to be because the rate of rotation and some very low-frequency sound resonating in the atmosphere appear to make this hexagon stand out just as it would be if you were to, let's say, take a metal plate and run a violin's bow over it. So the atmosphere resonates. You know, there's a similar process happening in the sun. The sun rings like a bell, and we can see the cells of plasma in the sun resonating, and they form a pattern almost like a checkerboard. So the hexagon at the pole of Saturn shouldn't be too difficult to understand if you look at the ringing patterns in the gas of the sun as well.
What's new in the field of robotics, Sir Charles? These things are getting almost human-like.
You know, that's true. We're making more and more human robots, but I think the most exciting and important information in robotics comes from the fact that they have now created robots less than a millimeter in length, just a fraction of a millimeter long, at the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems. These tiny robots are about the size of pinpoints, and they act the way that a scallop does, by opening and closing the shell and pulsing the liquid to move through the water. These tiny scallops can be engineered to literally swim in the fluid in your bloodstream or in your eyeball. Nobody would have thought you could make a robot as tiny as a fraction of a millimeter, but they're looking at reducing these in scale, getting electronics inside them, and using them to perform surgery inside your blood vessels or inside your tissue. This is the beginning of the nano revolution.
Sure is. Roland's in North Dakota, first-time caller. Nolan, go ahead, Roland.
Yes, it's a pleasure. I have a question there for Sir Charles.
Sure.
You guys were talking a while back here about how much technology has increased. You guys were talking to a fellow about the eyesight, and then you made a comment about the hearing has improved, the technology is there. I have a daughter now that has been, she was born deaf, and I was wondering now, is there any sort of technology that can make a deaf person hear nowadays?
Actually, there is, but it depends strongly on why a person is deaf. If, for instance, you are born without the nerves that lead to the hearing center of the brain, then it's going to be extremely difficult to find a way of treating that. If you're born without the cochlea, the spiral structure of the inner ear that translates the vibrations of sound into neural signals, then that can be fixed because they have an artificial cochlea called an implant that they put in and wire right into the nervous system. So it really depends on the cause of the deafness. In most cases, we do have ways of treating that.
Well, that's magic when we do. Sir Charles, we're out of time. I want to wish you and your family a wonderful New Year's Eve and New Year's, and as we move into another year. Can you believe it?
Oh, it's amazing. And, George, I hope you have a wonderful 2015. Happy New Year to you and your family.
We'll talk to you many times in 2015, Sir Charles.
Thanks, you. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Up next, David Sirita joins me. He has got a number of things he wants to talk with us about, major topics. David, of course, is very deep, so get ready to put your thinking hat on. We're going to come back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, George@coasttocoastam.com. George@coasttocoastam.com.